Mark Stein's Poem of the Week.
Here's some rhymes for the times as we go from bad to verse. There is a whiff of revolution in the air, and of bloodlust too. Usually there's a time lag between those two things, between the idealistic phase and the descent into terror. With the French Revolution in 1789, the great poets were very taken by it, and we quote them still in such contexts. Wordsworth, in The Prelude, speaks for the youth on the streets, as he always does. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. Then came the Reign of Terror, which gave some of the revolution's supporters pause, although Coleridge attempted to argue that this was just a cloud of momentary aberration, and the storm would pass and the ship of freedom would sail on. And it was only the invasion of Switzerland in 1798 that finally soured him on French revolutionary violence. Forgive me, freedom. Oh, forgive those dreams. I hear thy voice. I hear thy loud lament from bleak Helvetia's icy caverns sent. I hear thy groans upon her blood-stained streams. But in a sense, these poets are too good and too poetical for what's going on. I mentioned during our serialisation of the Scarlet Pimpernel, which is well worth listening to in these times, I mentioned the fate of the Princesse de Lamballe, confidant of Marie Antoinette, a petite lady dressed in white. The mob raped her, cut off her breasts, bludgeoned her skull with a pike staff, disemboweled her, chopped off her head, and paraded it through the streets on a pike with her decapitated naked body following behind. They stole strands of hair from the head. The head was taken to a cafe where the cheering patrons toasted it. Once the mob gets a taste for blood, for heads on pikes, it's very difficult to wean them off it. So here's a piece on that very theme from a book I bought in a second-hand store when I was about 12 or so, called Poems for the Poor. They're verses, really, not poetry at all very tumpty-tumpty. No one would argue that their author belongs in the same pantheon as Wordsworth and Coleridge, but they have the sense of a mob intoxicated by violence, drunk on depravity. Here's the greater part of it, first published by Harrison and Sons in 1885 from Poems for the Poor by John Lawrence Longstaff under the nom de plume Peter Primrose, the Song of the Blood-Red Republican. For a mad, wild rout that is dancing about, we're behaving uncommonly well. Though we deafen the street with laughter and shout, with drum and cymbal and bell. So foot it, Jeannot, and trip it, Jeannette, the music to dance to is good. The dance is of death, the best ever set, and the drink is the bluest of blood. For myself, I admit, I'm no cannibal yet, the idea is at present too fresh. But there are a good few who prefer a ragout of a juicy aristocrat's flesh. Then kick up, Jeannot, and caper, Jeannette, the taste may be gained, and it should. Today a young beauty wiped off a big debt by drinking her lover's heart's blood. Oh, terribly dry is the dull cold sky, and the dust is blindingly driven, but the liquid that drains from aristocrat's veins lays better than showers from heaven. So dance you, Jeannot, and dance you, Jeannette, let the hatchet and knife make a flood. Let us cut up a duke while we pirouette and stick a prince of the blood. Can you ask why we slay this lord of today? Dull seems your intelligence, rather. Committed no crime? Oh, hang it, I say, why, the man is the son of his father. Then gamble, Jeannot, and frolic, Jeannette, any day you can dabble in mud. 'Tis but once in a lifetime the chance you may get to soak in aristocrat's blood. A new manufactory flourishes near, the finest of leather they tan. Not cowhide or pigskin or chamois is here. The hides are of woman and man. Then footage shall know, and trippage shall net, and off to the tannery scud, from a duchess's skin the best leather you get, when cleansed of aristocrat's blood. Dance gaily, dance daily, from morning to night, with trophies entwine every head. Drain still the rich liquor with frenzied delight, and drunken, disdain yourselves red. Yes, dance you, Jeannot, and dance you, Jeannette, far wilder than Bacchus's brood, for there crimsons, intoxicates, maddens you yet. Not the grape, but aristocrat's blood. A poem from Me to You by John Lawrence Longstaff. And in today's America, you don't have to own a chateau to be an aristocrat. You can be merely a storekeeper, perhaps of a despised barbershop or nail salon. The poet André Chénier died in the Reign of Terror. Robespierre ordered his execution, and he was guillotined with the Princesse Joseph de Monaco on July 25th, 1794. He was one of the last to be killed on Robespierre's orders, because Robespierre himself was guillotined on July 28th, 3 days later. André Chénier is memorialized as the eponymous protagonist of Umberto Giordano's opera. This was always a great gut-wrenching showstopper on stage for Maria Callas. The revolutionary mob sets fire to her childhood home. Look, the place that cradled me is burning. And her mother dies trying to save her daughter. I bring sorrow to those who love me, but it was during this sorrow that love came to me. From Andrea Chénier, Mamma Morta.
Notte alto io conversi
Maria Callas, La Mamma Morte. This spring was the 500th anniversary of the Great Massacre at Tenochtitlan in Mexico while Cortés was out of town. Whenever I think of Cortés, I think of him as Stout Cortés, which is by far the most famous adjective appended to the man. That's stout in the sense of sturdy and determined and resolute, not a fat bloke. I've no idea whether Cortés was morbidly obese, as Nancy Pelosi would say, but it doesn't seem the sort of thing Charles V, I think that's Carlos I in Spanish, it doesn't seem the sort of thing Charles V would have been looking for in a conquistador. Stout Cortés comes from a sonnet by John Keats, written two centuries ago, and it's not really about Cortés at all. In fact, it's rather remarkable because it's a hit poem about the virtues of one translation of a foreign language over another. I mean, think about that. If you were pitching it to a publisher, yeah, I've got this boffo idea. It's about what a knockout this translator is compared to the other fellas. But that's exactly how it happened. Keats did not read Greek, which meant he read Homer in translation. And in those days, the preferred translations were by Pope and Dryden, and they were rather literary and elegant renderings of the original. And then one evening, Keats was with Charles Cowden Clarke. They'd been friends since boyhood because Keats was a pupil at a school run by Clarke's dad. And his pal brought with him a translation of Homer by the Elizabethan playwright George Chapman. And it's much more primal and raw and basic in its language. And it brought Homer alive for Keats in a way that he never had been. And he and Clarke stayed up into the wee small hours with Keats yelping with delight at every passage that caught his fancy. And the next morning, at 10 a.m., when a bleary Charles Cowden Clarke staggered downstairs for breakfast, he found this sonnet waiting for him upon the table. Keats fancies himself, like Cortés, a traveller in realms of gold. But in this case, they're literary realms. He travels imaginatively. But listen for the neat writer's trick he pulls off. The first half of the poem uses a lot of frilly and writerly language. Bards in fealty, deep-browed, demean. It's consciously poetic, so to speak. And then in the second half, as soon as he mentions this revelatory translator Chapman, the language itself turns raw, loud and bold, stout indeed. And the poet is as an astronomer, discovering a new planet. He undoubtedly has in mind Uranus, which was discovered in 1781 and is the first planet of our time, as opposed to those known to the ancient world. And the poet is also as one with Stout Cortés from Medellín in Castile, surveying the Pacific Ocean for the very first time. First published in The Examiner on December the 1st, 1816, by John Keats, on first looking into Chapman's Homer. Much have I travelled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told that deep-browed Homer ruled as his demesne. Yet did I never breathe its pure serene till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, or like Stout Cortés when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. A poem from Me to You by John Keats, on first looking into Chapman's Homer. I had a schoolmaster called Mr. Chapman who taught Homer, so the title tickled us, lads. The climax of the poem Stout Cortez silent upon a peak in Darien never actually happened, because Darien is in Panama, not Mexico. And the first conquistador to see the Eastern Pacific was not Cortez, but in fact Balboa in the year 1513. Cortez saw the ocean later in Mexico and Honduras. Whether that was an error on Keats's part or dramatic license, we shall never know. But for me, it cannot mar that sonnet. The Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra under Caspar Richter, and the march from an opera about Stout Cortez, Fernand Cortez, ou La Conquête du Mexique, the conquest of Mexico. That subtitle would probably be illegal today, but it wasn't a little over two centuries ago when Gaspare Spontini composed his opera. So much for Cortez, just as stout, but famously ill-fated when it came to his ultimate voyage with Sir John Franklin of the poor doomed Franklin expedition through the Northwest Passage. And it's only in the last 6 years that his two ships, HMS Erebus and HMS Terror, have been found, the latter in pristine condition just south of King William Island. Sir John loomed large in the Victorian imagination, and much was written of him. But did you know his first wife was a poet? Eleanor Ann Porden met Franklin in 1818, just before he set off on HMS Trent, and shortly thereafter published a poem in admiration called The Arctic Expeditions. Sail, sail, adventurous barks, go fearless forth. Storm on his glacier seat, the misty north. Give to mankind the inhospitable zone, and Britain's trident plant in seas unknown, etc. It's a rather earnest piece. Miss Porden was just 22, and the Arctic Expeditions doesn't compare to her best-known work from later that year, Coeur de Lion, her epic poem of the Third Crusade. So I have a slight preference for this private verse. In 1822, Franklin was away on the copper mine expedition, charting the land between Hudson's Bay and Canada's northern shore. It was a wild ride. There was at least one murder and rumours of cannibalism as the starving crew were driven to eating lichen. Franklin would later be known as the man who ate his boots, because by that point they were the only thing left. But when he writes to Eleanor Porden, the only thing he complains about is what a pain in the neck it is trying to write his narrative of the expedition, his journal. Eleanor's publisher, John Murray, had a deal with the Admiralty, and explorers' accounts of their adventures were big sellers. I've always loathed that self-regarding line of precious writers, that there is nothing so terrifying as a blank page. But for John Franklin, it was true. In the midst of wastes of ice stretching to the far horizon, polar bears and grizzlies, not to mention murder, cannibalism, your left boot for breakfast and your right boot for dinner, what truly paralyzed him with fear was the blank page of his journal. So to jolly him up, in December 1822, Eleanor Porden sent him a letter in the voice of her beloved, a great explorer struggling to write. Hey-ho, alack and well-a-day, was ever wight like me distressed? What shall I write? What can I say? Will this or that way read the best? Oh, that my foe a book had written, so spake the wisest of mankind. Alas, his curse my head has smitten, and write I must, though ill-inclined. I've faced the battle o'er and o'er, from steel or fire I did not shrink. Not ocean in its wildest roar could fright me like that drop of ink. A field of snows, but one blank page. Bears, icebergs, buffaloes together. I'd rather all there might engage than touch that one poor goose's feather. I'm in the treadmill all the day. No rest is mine, and in my dreams gaunt imps of darkness round me play, with ghastly papers filed in reams. And there, oh there, such lines are traced, like flints in chalk, uncounted strata. And last, one long dire list prefaced with that tremendous word errata. Bright Phoebus, now thy help bestow, though fear from thine my course has laid, where faint and wan thy summer's glow, where winter frowns in endless shade, give me thy smile for once, but how? Their wayward power, 'tis worse and worse. I ask thee but for prose, but now my thoughts are jingling into verse. My mind unwanted numbers haunt. I'm clean bewitched. I'm in a flurry. Avaunt, ye crew of rhymes, avaunt. Why, what will Barrow say, or Murray? O God of scribblers, guide my course. Assist me, though the phrase be evil, to turn my offspring out of doors and give it fairly to the devil. A poem from me to you, and from Eleanor Porden to John Franklin, to spur him to write his journal. Notice the mention of their very publisher toward the end, John Murray. The couple were wed a few months later, and she gave birth to their daughter 9 months after that, before the little girl was a year old, and while her husband was away on his second Arctic land expedition, Eleanor Ann Porden was dead of consumption at the age of 29. So it fell to Sir John's second wife, Jane, to bear the loss of the Franklin expedition and to send ships out to try to discover her husband's fate. This song was written about 1850 and is still sung nearly a century and three quarters later, Lady Franklin's Lament.
'Twas homeward bound one night on the deep, swinging in my hammock, I fell to sleep. I dreamed a dream. Gallant crew, 100 crewmen, they sailed away across the frozen ocean in the month of May to seek that passage around the point where we poor crewmen do sometimes go. On a mountain of ice his ship was thrown into the frozen ocean. His men did go where the Eskimos in their skin canoes are the only ones that ever got through. Now in Baffin Bay, where the whale fish blow, or the fate of Franklin, no man will know. The fate of Franklin, no man can tell. I do hope that Franklin on this earth do dwell. And now my burden, oh, it keeps me pain for my long lost Franklin. I've crossed the main. 10,000 pounds I'd surely give to know that Franklin on this earth do.
Innu with Lady Franklin's Lament. Nobody believed in our new gods until the day before yesterday, and our forebears would find them, as our great universities are now wont to say, problematic. Diversity, for example, is a morally neutral concept. But that wouldn't be the most puzzling aspect of the scene to them. Rather, it would be the acceptance by large numbers of people of a state ideology that cannot be questioned. You're either on team BLM, or you're fired, cancelled, forced to grovel, or at minimum, forever tainted. Our forebears would be surprised at the widespread abandonment in nothing flat of the idea that one can have differences of opinion, even within those broadly on the same side. And they would be dismayed by the acceptance of as stupid a notion as that only approved opinion can be permitted. Although they'd also be amused, I think, by the ruthless enforcement of diversity until it simply becomes a cover for stultifying and soul-killing uniformity. I think most listeners will know a line or two of William Blake, even if it's only Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright or the words of Jerusalem, assuming that hasn't yet been banned, except for 3 years on the Sussex coast near Bognor Regis. He spent his entire life in London, so almost everything he wrote Andrew was an act of sheer imagination. And we seem to be losing the imaginative capacity that makes such a life possible. I chose this poem because it's sympathetic and humane. And those qualities are likewise in short supply right now. Blake was implacably opposed to slavery, but this piece is not agitprop and indeed not particularly political. It is about a black boy who contrasts himself with a white boy, but it is not a poem of black and white. It is shaded and capable of different readings, starting with the first verse, in which the child narrator alludes to the symbolic distinction the English language draws between the word white, as good and pure and angelic, and black, symbolizing something dark and wicked. The black boy acknowledges the distinction and subtly rejects it. I am black as if bereaved of light, as if. In other words, he only gives the appearance thereof. But as his mother tells him, in the African jungle, the southern wild, God is in the sun, and the sun shines upon them, and that sunlight is God's love. This is quite a radical concept for 1789, when most of those Mr. Blake encountered in a day's social intercourse in London assumed Africans were heathens, savages. And as their sunburned bodies testify, the mother tells the boy, the heat of God's love can be hard to bear. But this blackness is just a cloud, as whiteness is also a cloud. The black is more obvious, but the African boy has a far heavier burden of suffering, which the white boy is sheltered from. But nevertheless, the mark of that shelter, his paleness, is also a cloud. And in God's heaven, at their father's knee, with both clouds lifted, they will be equal and similar. This is far beyond anything your average opponent of the slave trade believed in Blake's day. And a conventionally observant Anglican would at the very least have been startled by the poet choosing to conjure a black child and his mother as the repository of Christian selflessness. But he did. A man who had never set foot out of London chose to write in the voice of an African boy. This was audacious in 18th century England. Today we're so advanced that it would be forbidden on the grounds of cultural appropriation. First published in 1789 in Songs of Innocence by William Blake, the little black boy. My mother bore me in the southern wild, and I am black. But oh, my soul is white, white as an angel is the English child. But I am black, as if bereaved of light. My mother taught me underneath a tree, and sitting down before the heat of day, she took me on her lap and kissed me, and pointing to the east, began to say, look at the rising sun, there God does live, and gives his light, and gives his heat away. And flowers and trees and beasts and men receive comfort in morning, joy in the noonday. And we are put on earth a little space, that we may learn to bear the beams of love. And these black bodies and this sunburnt face are but a cloud, and like a shady grove. For when our souls have learned the heat to bear, the cloud will vanish. We shall hear his voice saying, come out from the grove, my love and care, and round my golden tent like lambs rejoice. Thus did my mother say, and kissed me. And thus I say to little English boy, when I from black and he from white cloud free, and round the tent of God like lambs we joy, I'll shade him from the heat till he can bear to lean in joy upon our father's knee, and then I'll stand and stroke his silver hair and be like him, and he will then love me. A poem from Me to You by William Blake, the little black boy, 2 1/3 centuries old, and a poem beyond the capacity of today's snarling mob even to understand. The first black African to vote in an English election was Ignatius Sancho, who cast his ballot for the House of Commons in the 1774 and 1780 campaigns. He was born on a slave ship and became known in London as the Extraordinary Negro. He was. He ran a greengrocer's shop, and he wrote plays and books and minuets.
The Mark Stein Show is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.